Well, welcome again to Food Conversations, dear listeners, season 6. Before we begin, of course, we must never forget that we are living and working on Shrempikulu, the ancestral, unceded, and actually stolen lands of the Shkrepmik people. It's obvious that doing everything we can to resolve this situation is an important and necessary responsibility for every one of us. Now, today we're delighted to welcome a special guest to Food Conversations. Special because, as lead minister of First Community, Salmon Arms United Church, Jenny Carter has transformed the church into a bustling hub for community engagement. But also special with regard to the voice of the Shuswap, because Jenny played an instrumental role in finding a new home for CKVS FM 93.7 after we were forced to move out of the downtown activity center, and she offered us a place in the new green space project that she was initiating at the church at a time when we were really struggling to find a suitable venue for our studio. To be honest, it took no time at all for us to realize that this was absolutely the right place to locate a community radio station. And the rest, as they say, is history. With Jenny and First Community respectively as our host and home, the voice of the Shuswap has enjoyed several years of felicitous interactions that promise to continue long into the future. So a very warm welcome, Jenny, to Food Conversations.
Thank you, Warren. It's so good to be here.
Well, you know, it's been a long time coming having you on the show, and there's a lot we're going to talk about today. But why don't we start with the fact that you're actually the minister here. And how long have you been the minister here?
I've been the minister here for 8 years.
8 years.
Yes.
Now, is that standard for church ministers? I don't. No, never having been one, I don't know what the standard rule is, but I know that there's a tendency for ministers to move from place to place, and I know that's been part of your life as a minister.
Right. So in the United Church, I would say a standard time to stay in a congregation is between 3 to 5 years, but I've been fortunate, or my congregations have been somewhat unfortunate, perhaps. I stay a long time.
Well, please stay longer. I'm just going to make it right out there for everybody to know. What did you know about Salmon Arm before you ended up here?
Oh,
I mean, you must have an inventory of ministries you could go to or something like that.
Well, we do. And I'm ashamed to say that my sum total knowledge of Salmon Arm was driving through it as a kid on holidays.
Well, it obviously wasn't that bad.
Oh, no, I love Salmon Arm, but I grew up in Kamloops, and so Kamloops people, for whatever reason, spent summers on the North Shore, right, of the Shuswap, not this side of the lake. Yeah. So I didn't really know much about it, but I have to tell you, I've never worked in a friendlier, more generous community than Salmon Arm, so I'm really happy that I landed here.
So what would you say, if you were sort of putting together a piece of what you now have seen of Salmon Arm, what would you say was the sort of salient, or what were the sort of couple of salient features about the community that really have come to be part of your knowledge?
Salient parts. Certainly, it's one of the friendliest places. People actually speak to one another when they're downtown.
Astonishing.
You know, which is a bit shocking, and it took a little bit to getting used to. I kept thinking, do I know you? which was lovely. But I think it's the generosity of spirit here. There's also a whole lot of nonprofits that work around not just food sustainability, but protecting, addressing climate change, you know, protecting the waterfront and the water. And that's a salient part of this community.
And you invited a number of them into this green space concept, I would call it, mm-hmm. that you created here. Why don't you just, because I'm not sure I'll get them all right, what groups are now here in this space?
So currently we have, of course, CKVS, Voice of the Shuswap. We have
amazing.
We have Essie's Place, which is an LGBTQ two-spirited plus advocacy and program group that seek to address many needs of those communities. We have the Métis Association, who are right down here. They are actually in the building. But we have other partners that maybe not be inside of the building, but we partner with them in a more ad hoc way. Mm-hmm. And that list is very long.
Yeah.
That list is
very
long.
I've come into the building and there's been groups meeting and I say, hello, I know you're here for a reason. I just Absolutely. Have no idea what it is.
Absolutely.
So as you would say, this is not my first gig. So how long had you been in ministry before you actually came here?
Well, that's a difficult question. I mean, I was...
I know you started at age three. We'll get into that in a moment.
Absolutely. So I did start in children and youth ministry way back in the day. And some of those kids are now 42, 43, so that's a bit shocking for me. But I was ordained in 2001, so yeah.
So do the math, everybody. Now, your first posting was in Vanderhoof, mm-hmm. but you grew up in Kamloops, and yet you were born in Vanderhoof.
That's right.
So speaking as it being your first gig, what was it like then? What was it like going back to a town that you'd been in as a baby, but you didn't really know a lot about, but somebody must have known you were.
Oh, they certainly did. So Vanderhoof, that's where my father was born and his parents homesteaded there. And so when I went back to Vanderhoof as the minister, I mean, I left there when I was 18 months old. My parents left with me. I didn't head out on my own.
Was kind of them.
But when I came into my first meeting with my new congregation, one of the women there said, I know you. She walked home to her house and came back with the clipping of my baptism from the newspaper that she had clipped out.
You can't get away, can you?
You just can't. And so I was like, you know, local child returns home, makes good, right?
Yes, right. I looked up Vanderhoof, of course. It's got about 4,000 people in it now. It was a little bit fewer when you were born. But... it's also very near to the geographic center of British Columbia.
It is.
It's probably on a big plaque outside the city when you drive in.
It is.
We are the center of British Columbia. Is it really?
It is.
Well, how do you like that? That's how you make money. You take advantage of your natural gifts. Now, we shared about the fact that you'd always wanted to be a minister as long as you can remember. And I have this vision of a little three-and-a-half-year-old saying, I want to go to Sunday school. Yeah. make it happen to your parents. Please share that story with listeners because it's just too good.
Certainly. So I don't really know why I wanted to go to Sunday school so bad. Perhaps it was because I would see my older siblings heading off, and maybe it was part of that. Mm. But I just knew I had to get there. Mm. And at that time, I was too little to be in a Sunday school class. They wanted to put me in the baby fold, as they used to call it. And
discriminatory.
Ageism, way back when. And I asked my mom, please let me go to Sunday school. So my mom talked to the Sunday school teacher, and as the conversation was reported to me, the Sunday school teacher said, well, she can come today, and if she's very good, she can stay. And so I was very good because they let me come back. So it was, you know, I can't underestimate how important, overestimate how important that was in my journey to be welcomed into that group. And I don't remember that Sunday school teacher's name. All I remember is that she was an angel to me. Right.
Yeah. She adopted you as her spiritual child.
Absolutely.
Your mom and dad, of course, were your actual parents, and each of them brought a different perspective to you that has shaped the way your career has moved on. Your mom, you described as sort of a social consciousness, and your father more of a kind of a spiritual influence. Why don't you parse that a little bit?
I had amazing parents. And my father was a very smart man, a quiet man, but a very profoundly spiritual person. And so I would come up with all manner of questions, and I would go to my dad and talk to them about whatever I was talking about, wondering about. And he never treated me like a little kid that didn't know anything. Mm-hmm. He would just simply sometimes sit down and have a conversation with me, sometimes continue gardening or building a rock wall, whatever he'd be about. And he was very instrumental as a small person in my life spiritually, but throughout my life, right? He was that kind of person, that kind of wisdom.
Remind listeners again that I'm speaking with Jenny Carter, who's the lead minister of our home here, the First Community.
Yeah.
Jenny, your mom was active in doing things and living out sort of helping others.
Oh, absolutely. I really believe that the strong social ethic that I have, but my siblings, in the case my brother had and also my sister currently has, that strong social ethic that you're supposed to help your neighbor and help meet needs and those kinds of things, that came from our mother. And my mother was instrumental. She knew the people in the neighborhood that didn't have enough food, and she would organize food being dropped off at their house. People that couldn't afford shoes for their kids, she arranged shoes to be dropped off. Clothes, she would bring home secondhand clothes. She would wash them. She would remake them into something that was currently in style, iron them, press them, put them on hangers, and deliver them so they look brand new for these little kids. Yeah.
Now, your mother was doing this, but she wasn't somebody who didn't have an independent spirit, and she, at one point, quit the church, the United Church, I guess. She quit it because there was an argument with the minister. I mean, there was a thing going on. That is such a wonderful story. Please.
Right. So I grew up, like I said, in Kamloops, and I grew up in Brocklehurst, which was, when we first went there, was just a bunch of streets pushed into apple orchards in order to make room for the baby boomers. So the parents got together, wanted to start a United Church, and they did. And they saved all kinds of money to build their church. They met at the community hall. And time passed, and they had a nice little tidy sum of money, but the United Church, in its wisdom, decided that they shouldn't build a church. They should amalgamate with the one in North Kamloops. And so the minister that they were going to get came, and they just talked about what they were going to do with that pot of money that they'd been working so hard to accumulate to build a church. And the minister thought it would be a good idea to use that money for his traveling expenses and his car. And my mother...
Bad minister.
My mother said, well, I think we should give it to the poor. And he said to her, Mrs. Ewan, we don't have poor people in the United Church. To which my mother replied, and you don't think that's a problem? And so that was the day she quit the United Church.
And maintained her personal stance on this sort of thing.
Yeah, that's right.
I mean, your father also was not deeply involved in religious matters. He actually had a construction company.
My dad.
Yes, and as a result, you were exposed to a lot of things that had to do with construction companies, and you did a few jobs before and around when you were going to university eventually, and some of them were interesting. Driving a front end loader at a smelter, and risking your life as you crawled up these piles of slag to try to avoid dumping. You never dumped.
No.
Must have been a good front-end loader driver.
I wasn't so much worried about preserving my own life. I was more concerned with preserving the life of the front-end loader, because they had put the fear of God right in me about if I dumped that loader, I was in trouble.
Serious trouble. You also worked a little bit for your dad.
I did.
What kind of stuff did you do with
him? I did a few sub-trades for him. So there's a lot of times I worked as laborer, but I was also one of his chief insulators. I would take the contract for that and insulate the houses that he was building, which, you know, I got pretty good at it and pretty fast. I'm glad I didn't make a career out of it, because
you'd have fiberglass in your lungs forever.
Absolutely.
We're a food show, so I'm going to bring up some of this you did related to food, and one was being a night baker. You were the baker. A lot of baking goes on in the middle of the night in bakeries around the world. Was that one of those jobs where you had to get everything ready at night?
Oh, for sure. I mean, so as night baker, I mean, I have to clarify, I'm not a baker. It was a fake and bake kind of bakery. So, you know, I basically pulled out the frozen stuff, defrosted it, proofed it, baked it, bagged it.
Right?
It was not particularly glamorous, but it was something to do.
But later you did get into a job that was, if not more glamorous, was at least more complex and meant you had to do a lot of things around the food experience, and that was being a manager in a restaurant.
Right.
What did you learn there that was part of what you later did when you became a minister?
Well, so much, you know, just the whole practicalities, the logistics around managing a restaurant, from training staff to cook, to serve, to clean, all of those kinds of things, all those staff relations, doing the ordering. So logistically, it was very helpful. But probably one of the biggest things was around how we treat one another as staff, that people are doing hard work and working hard are deserve respect and their pay and all of those, and a good working environment. But in terms of the experience with the diners, it's that sense of hospitality, right? It's that sense of welcoming in and helping provide an experience that is fun or meaningful or rich or whatever it is people are looking for when they come in and want to stay.
Was that part of what gave you the pleasure, is having, you know, you're welcoming these people into a space where you're hoping they will have a positive, really wonderful kind of experience?
Oh, absolutely. Without a doubt. Without a doubt.
Now, we've had guests in the show who've worked in the restaurant business, and there's often an image of the business that, especially in the area where food is cooked and prepared, there's a lot of tension, a lot of people running around yelling at each other. How did you cope with that kind of historical pattern that's developed in restaurants? Obviously, you must have seen some of it, and from what you're saying, you would have tried to mitigate it.
Well, I would like to say I was perfect and never lost my cool once. That's simply not true. Sometimes when it's high volume, high pressure, everybody, and you're working as fast as you can and it's hot, tempers can flare. Mm-hmm. So that is why restaurants have great big walk-in coolers with a really heavy door. So if you get hot and you're angry,
you
can go into the cooler and you can get over your sweet self, however you choose to do that. And then you can come back out refreshed.
Yes, the door opens magically when you've cooled
Absolutely.
Off. Absolutely. This addresses the question of establishing community, because food is a wonderful, and we'll talk more about that later, but it's a place, it's an entity in our lives that brings us together and creates almost automatically a certain sense of community, and people start to talk to each other.
Mm-hmm.
You must have seen that in the restaurant then, and of course later on it became very much part of what's happening here at First Community. Do you see a sense of continuity there?
Oh, absolutely, right? It's the people, when they sit down and break bread together, I mean, people do it in their homes, but also in the restaurants and you know, at First Community now, sitting down, breaking bread together is, yes, it's about the food, but it is about the conversation. It's about the deepening of relationships. It's about getting to know other people and letting other people get to know you. And it's very profound. Like, from my faith tradition, that sense of table fellowship is pretty key. We even have a sacrament built around that.
I'm led to believe that, yes.
You know, but absolutely, it is about that sitting down. It builds community, it builds trust, and it helps us feel connected to one another. And that's, I can't stress how important that is.
You know, it's interesting from a biological point of view, when you eat food, it activates the parasympathetic system, which is the vegetative systems in our body, whereas the other side, the sympathetic system, is the fight or flight response. And when you overtake the fight or flight response with the vegetative, let's just enjoy what we're doing, it's a process that leads to a different state of mind.
Absolutely.
So it really is incorporated into our physiology as well. So, speaking of ologies, after you'd high school and a few jobs and things, you went off to UBC.
I did.
And you took a bachelor's degree, Bachelor of Arts, in sociology and psychology. Now, this sounds like a plan emerging here, learning things that would obviously be extremely helpful for you as a minister. So what did sociology and psychology give you that helped you on your way?
That's a good question. So it was very much a plan. I was very intentional about it.
There's a plot here.
Let's use the word plan. It's sociology gave me an understanding of, helped give me an understanding of systems and how we are all living within systems upon systems. And that can affect everything from what we do for a living or whether we have money or, a house to live in, all of those things. And so I really wanted to take that so that I could understand what needed to be addressed, you know, in terms of a social ethic, but also is trying to understand the people that I would be ministering alongside of. And psychology, well, it's just that, again, that insight into why we humans do what we do.
What makes people tick.
Absolutely.
I think is the phrase you use. Well, that was the beginning, but the next step was a big step. How much of a gap was there between your undergrad and your grad? Did you go off and do some work of other sorts?
So I would like to say the gap was small. But it was, it took me a while to finish my undergrad degree because I was busy working for the church at the time in children and youth ministry. And so, So by the time I actually was granted my degree, my BA, I was off to the VST, Vancouver School of Theology, the very first semester I could get there.
So the sociologists and psychologists of this world knew they'd lost you before you actually disappeared.
Right.
So the school you went to was the school at the time at UBC in a big building called the Chancellor Building that was known to its friends as the Castle.
That's right.
And I remember being on the campus and thinking, if there was a building that I could go and study in, I'd like to go there because the arts building was kind of mundane and a little more utilitarian.
Mm-hmm.
The degree you achieved there was the Master of Divinity.
Right.
What was it like walking in? Here's this, you know, they say the inner child is with us all the time.
Right.
You walk into this space, this beautiful building. The three-year-old who wanted to go to Sunday school is finally going to the place where it all starts in the real world. What was that like for you?
It was simply amazing. As I walk through because there are big doors, like it's kind of a, I don't know what the architectural term is. It looks to be Gothic, but it's not Gothic. It's pseudo-Gothic,
it's
whatever.
It's quite monumental.
Yes. And so I walk through the doors and I remember I was thinking, walk slow, take it in. I've waited my whole life to get here, is exactly what I remember thinking. And even now I get goosebumps thinking about that day.
I've got goosebumps too with you just telling about it. I'm going to remind our listeners that I'm talking with Jenny Carter, who's the lead minister at First Community, also known as United Church. So it was the culmination, I mean, a culmination of where you were heading. So what happened when you got there? When you actually had to sit down and study and stuff like that?
It was heart opening, spirit opening. It was a great education. This is back in the day where you actually had to go to the library and spend time in the stacks to research things. And I had marvelous professors. I draw upon that education even now, every day. I mean, I received a training there that was amazing, but the ability to think theologically that's probably my greatest gift from Vancouver School of Theology, so that I'm doing, you know, a theological critique of most things in my life, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which it was brilliant. I loved going there.
Were your fellow students on that same path? Did some of them have a more, as I said earlier, utilitarian approach, or was there a kind of a special spirit in the school?
Well, there was a special spirit in the school, but it wasn't so it's a school that has that trains Anglicans, Presbyterians, United Church people, and a very ill-named category of other. So and so there was a real different mix theologically, and there are some that came that probably really struggled with the first year studies because it was biblical criticism, where you're exploring these texts on every level, historical criticism, literary criticism, all of those kinds of things, so that you can, you know, sort of pare down to what the meaning is. And I know some folks, it was hard for them to make the leap. For me, it was like a drink of cool water that just refreshed my spirit. It was amazing.
So what you're describing is bringing your mind and your intellect as well as a focus on spiritual matters that are maybe less physical and tangible, but you were exploring in some detail what the meaning of texts and mm-hmm. concepts were. It was a university kind of theological training. It had an intellectual content to it.
Oh, absolutely. And so there's a whole school, that's a whole part of that curriculum that's systematic theology, where you have to take what you believe that your faith, your denomination, and scripture is telling you, and apply it to real life issues. That's where the real meat comes from.
So you left the school at some point. You had a graduation ceremony. Mm-hmm. What was the graduation ceremony like?
Oh.
Or did you go?
I did, absolutely. We worked hard for that degree. Yeah. It was great. It was I can't even remember where it was now. It was at Shaughnessy Heights United Church, anyway. Mm-hmm. And I remember crossing and getting my master's degree, and this isn't in my personality, but I just yeehawed. I went, woohoo. And I was quite surprised at myself.
Well, it's a wonderful thing to surprise yourself once in a while. So once you had developed your yeehaw gene, what came next? When you finish a degree in divinity school, do you look at the wanted postings list or something like that, or what do you do?
So the very first thing after you graduate is you go through the ordination ceremony, which was probably the most impactful. And then when I graduated...
Impactful in what way?
It was simply when you know you're on the right path and the universe affirms that path, impactful in that way. Hmm. It's just, it was amazing.
And, so you felt you were home.
Yeah, it is. It's about home. And so then after that, I was ordained back when the United Church still had this thing called transfer and settlement. So if you were a newly ordained person, the church sent you where they wanted you to be.
Sounds like the RCMP, actually.
Very much, yeah. And so new ordinands, especially women ordained people, usually got sent to small rural and northern communities.
Yes, because the men were wanting to go to the big urban centers.
That's right.
Sorry, boys and girls, if you didn't hear that, we'll repeat it at some point.
Yeah.
So, Vanderhoof, mm-hmm. did it come up because you said, oh, I remember that place. Obviously, you didn't really, but did it just seem like, oh, why not? Or did they send you there?
Well, they sent me there, but I had some choices. There were some places further north that I could have gone, or Vanderhoof. And so when I saw Vanderhoof, I thought, by all means, I should go there. Mm-hmm. It felt like the right decision, and it turned out to be the right decision, mm-hmm. right?
A good start.
It was a good start.
Well, you had a couple of decades and more being a minister in different places. Mm-hmm. What kinds of places did you go to? Obviously, they weren't all small, isolated rural communities.
No, Vanderhoof is the smallest. Then I spent a little over 10 years in Williams Lake and enjoyed my time there thoroughly. Absolutely loved it. Had a great congregation. And then came here after that, 8 years. So I've only had 3 pastoral charges.
So you must have been in Vanderhoof for quite a while then.
I was. Well, 4 years.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and yeah.
Well, there you are. Traveling around, but... not everywhere.
No.
Now, along the way, you were married. You mm-hmm. had a daughter, Sarah. Mm-hmm. The marriage came to an end in 2007. Your mother lived with you until her recent death. Mm-hmm. How is being a minister, how does that interact with these experiences that most of us share, the experiences of, you know, long-term relationships and then loss? You had a brother who also died. Mm-hmm. Being a minister, how did this affect how you interacted with these things? I know they're very personal experiences, but nevertheless, everybody in your family knew you were a minister. It was hard to ignore.
For sure.
Just give us a little insight into how that interplay works.
So there's quite a few things around that, right? So there's the personal grief journey in all of that, right? It's no small thing to have a marriage end. It's no small thing to have a brother die and you know, your parents die. But those are, some of those things are very common experiences, mm-hmm. right? And so there's that personal grief and that working through. And I think if you have a healthy spirituality, I think that helps. Mm-hmm. But perhaps the biggest thing that I found going through those experiences was the value of community and how people sort of hold you up and they do what they can to help. I remember when my marriage broke up, especially, I was still ministering in Williams Lake and I didn't want to do a lot of talking about it. So what I did is I went to the choir and I said, here's what you need to tell people. The choirs and churches are really connected to everybody.
For sure.
Right? So I said, you need to tell folks that my marriage is over. I'm okay. I'm sad, but I'll be okay. And I don't want to talk about it. and that community, you know, they were amazing.
Yeah.
You know, they had made me meals. I don't know, to this day, I don't know who it was. But every Wednesday, I would get a stack of jokes slid under my office door. Like, so it's that value in community that gets you through. And in, with the recent death of my mother, it was the very same thing, that people just show up and ask you what you need and then help you get through.
Yeah, it's interesting when, in my line of work, you know, we attend to people who are unwell, and of course, as time goes by, at some point in time, we become those people.
Right.
And also we experience in our lives, our personal lives, people who are unwell and who mm-hmm. get sick and their lives are changed or they die. And I've often had people come in who are health professionals and other professionals dealing with people who talk about that. And they say, you know, I'm. It's not like when, you know, one of my neighbors or one of my patients or one of my clients died. It's like, it affects you much more. I said, well, yes, but you've also had all these other experiences of helping others through, so you see how the pattern goes. It's not like unfamiliar territory. And often that's just the best it gets. You can't not have it be uncomfortable, but you have these experiences.
Oh, very true. And so when my mother died, it was... I was with her for those 5 days, and I remember thinking, I'm being a terrible minister to my mother, but I think I'm being an okay daughter.
Well, of the two, I think she probably appreciated the latter more.
I think so.
So here we are in Salmon Arm. Mm-hmm. you've got your feet wet in other communities as a minister. You're here. And it's quite clear when you came here that things started to happen. There was a sort of transformative spirit, may I say. And because our first contact was around the green space mm-hmm. concept, so what were you starting to do then that has in fact changed a lot of things the way this particular institution runs?
Mm-hmm. Well, I have to give a lot of credit to the congregation, the United Church congregation here, because for decades, you know, they have had a real strong social ethic and they wanted to do good in the community. And they started a lot of the things that we see that we would deem helpful to people in need started here at the United Church. And when I came here a little over 8 years ago now, the congregation had become quite smaller and more elderly, and they still had the heart for the work, but no longer the energy for the work, mm-hmm. right? And so I wanted to figure out how they could still do the work.
And bring in new energy?
And bring new energy, absolutely. Right. And so it just occurred to me one day that there's a lot of very generous, spirited organizations in this Salmon Arm area, the Shuswap area, that everybody's working in their own silo. Everybody's competing for the same things. And what would it be like if we could... bring them all under one umbrella, so to speak, and share what we can and support one another where we're able. And that's really how it began. And it was like the fastest train I've ever been on. It just took off.
It's almost like you identified a need that was broader than just within the church. It was a sort of a social mm-hmm. need. Is this as common in other churches or other denominations or even, I mean, other religions. I don't expect you to give a great theological dissertation, but there is a pattern that I've, and I think others have observed in churches, that they kind of concern themselves with their congregation and their own business, and the community outside is known and people can participate in it, but mm-hmm. it isn't necessarily brought into the church space. Mm-hmm. And you did that.
Right.
Or you facilitated that.
Right, absolutely. So if I might delve in just a little bit to my faith tradition here, we in the United Church are keen to usher in, you know, do the work for the common good kinds of things. And so that's theologically it fits for us. In terms of other congregations or other denominations doing it, I think it's happening. Mm-hmm. In pockets all across, I can only speak for the Canadian context, and I think it's happening in pockets, but what I feel is a very ancient way of being church, people are thinking it's all new and fancy and very innovative, so it can be a bit of a tough explanation. People used to say to me, well, how is that church? And then after a while I said, hungry people being fed, people being clothed. You have to tell me how it's not.
Gee whiz, new stuff like food, clothing, and shelter.
Oh, I know.
I've never heard of it.
They might even be something about that in the Bible, Warren. I'm not sure.
We'll get on to that in a moment. let's talk about some of the concepts, the green space concept.
Right.
What was that all about?
Green space was really very much an intentional gathering of nonprofit groups that were working towards the priorities that this community felt were important. So food, climate, wellness in terms of physical, spiritual, emotional, all of those things, intergenerational needs. And so I really had quite a lot of freedom to go and talk to groups that were working in those priority areas and the ones that met our values, you know, things like justice and being inclusive and those kinds of things, and thought maybe we could work together. We had a building that was used... part of it was used 7% of available hours, and part of it was used 3%. So we had this...
Underused, we could say.
It was just not empty all the time. So we had space. That's what we had.
Remind listeners again that I'm speaking with Jenny Carter, who's lead minister of First Community. So First Community, let's talk about that. Mm-hmm. First Community. Mm-hmm. First Community. Mm-hmm. What's that concept?
So that concept is around building community. So we do that in three ways. We have our faith community that does all manner of good things, and they meet on Sundays. We have the green space community, which is the nonprofits and individuals that want to come and volunteer and do different things. And then we have the Nexus, which is a performing arts community that we seek to provide space for them. And so First Community is this kind of sense around it's the commons. It's a sense that whoever comes to this place has certain things that they can take from this place, but there's a responsibility to care for this place. So I would say that our whole ethos here is around building community and ensuring that all voices are heard and that people feel welcome.
And just briefly, talk a bit about the concept of eco-commoning, because... On our little guest profile, you said, passion, eco-commony.
Absolutely. So, first of all, it's a pretty cool word. So, eco-commons, it comes from the understanding of the commons that they used to have in England and Scotland, where it was a space that was held in common for the community. And people had... access to the commons so they could graze their sheep or whatever one did in ancient Scotland, I don't know. And but they also had a responsibility to care for the commons.
Sure.
So that's the commons part. So we exist, our view here is that we all exist within this shared earth. And it's all of our responsibility to care for one another and to care for the earth of which we are a part. And so that's the eco part, but it's more than that. Eco meaning household. We share this place. It's up to all of us to care for this place, which includes one another, right?
Yeah, listeners probably should know that Eco comes from a Greek word which means home, and economy means the study of the home and the management of it. And ecology means the science and the learning around our home. So we are finally coming home, as it were, and recognizing who we really are.
Absolutely.
So one thing we all have in common is we eat food. I actually looked it up, and it does happen to be a uniting factor in our lives. Now, you're a minister, I'm a physician, we're talking about food, so I had to go to the Bible and look up something
food.
So I just want you to know I'm trying to hold up my end here.
Perfect.
Ecclesiastes 9, verse 7.
Oh, that one.
Go, eat your food with gladness and drink your wine with a joyful heart, for God has already approved what you do.
Absolutely.
Now, if that isn't an endorsement of incorporating food into a spiritual sanctuary, I don't know what is. But you've always enjoyed cooking.
For sure.
You worked in a commercial, you worked in the food business for a while. And one of the first things you did when you came here was turn the kitchen into a commercial kitchen.
That's right.
That sounds like a plan.
That was definitely a plan. It might even border on plot.
Good to hear.
Originally, we had this space, again, terribly underused. And my hope was that we could have food programming there, right? And so we had to turn it into commercial kitchen. We had to meet certain standards, which I approve of, and we did that. So through our coolers, our freezers, our stoves, all of those things. My dream was to have food programming there. So we could run community kitchens where seniors come in, make some meals, take some home for their home, to also have a program where we could teach job skills to people who needed either a way to re-enter the workforce, or young people that were needing to get some skills to go into the workforce. So that was the dream. The Shuswap Food Action Society and Serena Kaner came and did many food programs for us once we became a commercial kitchen, even up to preserving food, which is becoming a lost art.
This is one of those situations, if you build it, they will come. Mm-hmm. You built a place where you could really seriously prepare food.
Right.
And people became attracted. In fact, the Shuswap Food Action Society is being pretty closely involved with what's going here.
Absolutely.
Here in the church.
Yeah.
So let's talk about some of the programs that you actually have. The community lunch on Wednesdays.
So that is probably one of the best times of my week, in actuality. So the beginning of that came when people were concerned about people who had no food and didn't have any place to get warm in the winter. And so from my time, I used to work in the downtown east side with people who were unhoused and had all manner of things. And I learned the value there of not just providing food, but providing a meal experience, a sitting down at table with one another. And then personally, I thought it needs to be really good food. It needs to be not just wholesome, but it needs to be something that we would serve our guests if they came to our home. And at the beginning, people would come, like the community lunch starts at 11:30 and it ends at 1. So when it began, people would come at 11:30 sharp, they'd eat their meal, and then they'd go. But as community has developed in that community lunch, people come at 11, they have their coffee, they have conversation, they eat their meal, and then they stay. And that has been amazing to me. All of the volunteers that come, we do a cooking day on Tuesday. They come, some people help me cook. I'm kind of the head cook on that. And other people come and serve on Wednesday. They serve the meal. But everybody sits down with everybody and eats together.
So you've actually seen an evolution in the consciousness that surrounds this meal.
Absolutely.
That's really been quite delightful. Mm-hmm. And also very much fits into the mandate of what spiritual activities are all about.
Absolutely.
Now you have another lunch on Mondays.
Right.
For the older folks in town. Not that there are anybody around here that we know.
No, certainly not myself. So that's called Lunch Bunch. And so that started...
I love Lunch Bunch. I know you told me it stuck once it came out.
Yes.
But so it's a good thing to stick to.
The lesson being, beware what you name things because the names stick. But anyways, self-described, right? There's lunch and there's a bunch of us. So that happens on Mondays, and it's another meal without cost. And it started 8 years ago when I realized that there was a significant group of at that time, seniors that ate every single meal by themselves. Mm. And so I thought, well, why don't we meet together for lunch on a Monday and just begin our conversations and have a conversation and be together. And that's another meal I started cooking. So typically I cooked all of the meals.
You practiced on the congregation.
Yeah, I did. I practiced on the congregation.
They're all here, though.
Well, they are all still here, which is lovely. And it has grown. So, you know, from kind of stilted and awkward conversations at the first meal tables, it has grown into truly a place of support, mutual support.
Similar kind of evolution then to the Wednesday community lunch, this beginning of people not maybe quite knowing how to connect to one another, and then as time goes by, that's the power of, as they say in the Bible, breaking bread together.
Absolutely.
It brings out this other side of people's state of mind. And then finally, of course, there's the catering service,
which is,
as I think you said, where I'm having a ball.
Oh, man. I'm having so much fun with that. And that, too, started sort of, not by accident, but so we thought, well, we have this commercial kitchen, we have able volunteers. How hard could it be? Anyway, it's just been an amazing thing. So we've catered all kinds of events, and from Christmas parties to weddings to whatever. And it's been a ball. It has been an absolute godsend.
And one of the tricks with a catering service is that everything has to arrive at the table that's supposed to be together.
Right.
And that is a whole art form in itself.
Right. And that's probably part of the thing I enjoy the most is because what I do the rest of my professional life, ministry, that takes up a different part of my brain. But this is just the logistics of it and the making sure that everything is coordinated and comes together. And that has been the most fun. And that the end product is good, right?
And after you all sit down, the people who put the meal together, you all sit down and you break a little bread together.
Sure.
And that's another... I think you described it as almost another biblical kind of notion that
for sure
you do it yourselves.
For sure. So anybody that is a part of a catering event, so there's the people that come and help, you know, prepare the food. There's myself. There's one of the most important aspects of our catering is the front of the house. And that's where the hospitality is really felt and extended. Even though our food is amazing, I firmly believe that the food could be okay, but if the hospitality is great and you feel welcome, that's the experience people take away. So we have the cooks that come and help cook. There's myself. There's the front of the house people, the servers, and the dish doers that clean up all that stuff afterwards. We meet together. Once we serve the food, we meet together and have our own meal, which is really a powerful thing, right?
And a lot of work.
And a lot of work.
And you work up a bit of a sweat, which is probably how it should be. Now, speaking of a lot of work, we're very fortunate today to have somebody else in the studio with us. Mary Scheidegger has been listening to this story, and she'll be preparing a brief summary, I'm sure, of this for the congregation. No, that's not going to happen. Mary, we're very happy to have you here because you're part of the team that's going to take some of the work that is really embedded in what Jenny is doing all the time and do some part of that for her. I'd like to welcome here, but also ask you what you've come to expect when you've come here to the church to work.
Oh, good question. Thanks for welcoming me. I'm quite new here with First Community, but I've known about First Community for a while. And I'm just so honored and pleased to be working with everybody at First Community, especially the wonderful Jenny Carter sitting here. it's such a great place. Now, from my experience outside looking in, I'm not necessarily
fully acquainted with
what could have been deemed as other, referred to before, and coming in and witnessing the work and the love and the spirit that is in this place.
But you also had some experience yourself working at Sorrento Center,
which
has a similar kind of ethos, to use that term, that bringing services to people and welcoming them and bringing and trying to establish a sense of community. And that's a continuation of what you'll be doing here.
Absolutely. I was there for 2 years. I had been in the for-profit world, and I'm very happy to be in the world that I'm in now. The word that is very common between the two organizations that I love is radical hospitality. And I just love that and embrace that, and I do everything I can to support this community to be exactly that, radical host.
And your role specifically will be office stuff?
My role is executive manager, which is a blanket term of my fingers in all the different areas. It is primarily to build community. There is that admin side of it that is less, and it's more about the building community and making sure that we are known, and those that are here are known too. And that those two things are sort of my primary roles, to make sure the world knows about little First Community in Salmon Arm.
Well, I'm quite sure you're going to be adding a great deal to this community within a community here, and I'm sure Jenny's really happy to have you here. Jenny, we're just nearing the end of the show, and I just wanted to give you the opportunity to say some last words for today, not for other days. There's a lot of, we're in a world right now that's torn apart in many places by conflict, violent behavior, lots of troubles in the world. I wonder if you could just share some thoughts about what food does in a world that's beset with these kinds of trials and tribulations, what role it is playing that you know of and can play in these kinds of times we live in.
Right. So I think the primary role of eating together is that we can remind one another that there is hope. We can remind one another that there is a place where you are cared for. And so in that sense, I think it's critical. Food plays a critical role. But also to be mindful that there are many people who do not have enough food, that can't afford food. And so by coming together, we remember perhaps who's not at the table and who needs to be. And I can't say strongly enough how important it is that we don't stay in isolation with ourselves and begin to despair. If we want a world that is has peace, if we want a world that addresses climate change, if we want a world where people have the basic necessities of life, we cannot despair. We have to turn to one another and remind ourselves that there's a way forward. Plus, what I've seen over the years, people get together, have conversations, there's an abundance in the community. Right? And we can share that.
Yeah, sharing, I think, is a key term here. I want to thank you, Jenny, and Mary as well, for being with us today and really laying out the path that you have followed in your own life, but also the path that you see possible for all of us to follow. I think there's nothing better than the process of sharing put into action. Not just thought about, but actually put into action. And food is one of the keys to that, but the concept is what drives the process forward.
Absolutely.
Thank you for sharing that concept with us today, the concept of community. Yeah. I used the word there.
There you go. Thank you, Warren.
Thank you, Mary. Yeah.